Welcome back, everybody, for another edition of the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Brett Haber, and I'm excited to welcome you to this podcast that brings you conversations with Hall of Famers and legends that go beyond the game. Each year, of course, the International Tennis Hall of Fame celebrates the sport's greatest players and contributors by presenting tennis's ultimate honor, induction into the Hall of Fame. This exclusive recognition represents the sum of a person's career as being truly at the top of the sport, the best of the best. As we are dedicated to preserving tennis's history and celebrating those incredible champions, we frequently ponder this question. What makes a Hall of Famer? What is that unique something that led to their historic success? Was it innate, or did they need to cultivate a winning mindset over time? Answering these questions and more is what the Tennis Worthy Podcast aims to do. Chris Bowers is an esteemed tennis journalist of more than three decades and biographer of Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic, and he will be chatting with our legendary guests here on Tennis Worthy. Today, Chris will chat with Hall of Famer Mary Pierce.
I always was just so curious. I want to see, if I give everything I have, how good can I be? Dreams are the fuel that fire you up those days when you're tired, when you don't want to do it, and you're wondering, why am I doing this? We feared for our lives, my mother, myself, and my brother, because, you know, you didn't know what my dad could do or was going to do, you know, at any moment. You see all your tennis life flash before your eyes and just really everything that you've been through, and you think, yeah, okay, this is what it's for, and it's all worth it. Always give 100% so that you don't ever, ever have any regrets.
Mary's entree into tennis could almost be the start of a Hollywood movie. Like Tracy Austin, with whom we spoke in episode 2, Mary was a young tennis phenom. She turned pro at 14. Mary attributes her success to her perseverance and hard work, but as many know, her success came at a price. Her father pushed her to an extreme, and at the age of 18, he was banned from being at her tournaments. We must warn listeners that this conversation may be difficult for those who've experienced an abusive parent or authority figure. I'll leave you now with Chris Bowers and Mary Pierce. Chris, take it away.
Mary, what do you think is the quality that makes you a Hall of Famer?
The first thing that comes to my mind is perseverance and hard work. To be able to be a Hall of Famer, it's being recognized as one of the best tennis players in the history of the game, and so that's the results that basically speak for themselves. And to be able to have those results, you know, what did it take in my life and everything that I have been through, I would say those were the first two things that popped into my mind and that allowed me and contributed for me to be able to have the success and to do what I did in my tennis career.
What's the thing you're most proud of in terms of the things that you had to do to be successful?
I think never giving up and believing in myself and always giving 100%. I think that's something that I am very proud of, is that I can look back at my career and say that I don't have any regrets because I always gave 100% of myself. I always wanted to see what is the best that I can possibly be. That was my challenge. That was my motivation to see, you know, if I give 100% of myself in everything that I do every day, and even in the small details, it's very hard to do. but if I can do that, then I can have no regrets, and I can see that I've done everything that I possibly can in my ability and my control and my power to be the best that I can be. And I always was just so curious. I want to see, if I give everything I have, how good can I be? How far will that take me? I don't know. And I'll never know unless I give 100% of myself every day.
And did you have that in other walks of life before you took up tennis? Or was tennis the thing you discovered that made you want to give everything?
Well, that's a good question. I think growing up, I enjoyed school. I was a good student in school, and I think that was probably just in me, and I didn't know it. It was just natural, I think, for me. It's just whatever I did, I always tried, I just tried to want to do it the best that I possibly could.
So are you a perfectionist? Because that's a slightly negative term,
you know,
isn't it?
It's interesting, that word, perfectionist. It depends, I think, how people portray it. And like you just said, it's a negative term. Can be. It depends on your mindset and how you look at it. I look at it as in the sense of wanting and striving and giving my best to be my best. And when I look back at my career, no, there was not perfection, because I am not perfect. I am a human being, and I have, you know, weaknesses and moments of doubt, or, you know, that's why you have your team around you to help you in those moments. And, you know, I think nothing is perfect, but you strive for excellence and you strive to be your best, and know that by in doing that, you can then have, you know, like I said, have no regrets, and you can be proud of yourself and keep your, and walk off the court. Every time I said that was a thing, I could always walk off the court with my head high, win or lose, knowing that I gave my best that day. And then you lose, then you learn from it. You take from that match and you say, why didn't I win? This is what I need to work on to get better and to keep improving. And it's a daily process, and not only as a tennis player, but as a person and as a human being. I look at it as a whole, as, and holistically, you know, what can I learn? I think that was something I think as well. I always wanted to learn something new every day. What can I learn today? And you can learn from people and situations. And having that openness and that humbleness and that growth mindset of always trying to learn something new every day and be better.
You started at the age of 10, which is relatively late by the stories of most of the players who make it to the top. And the story goes that you were just invited by a friend to hit some balls, and after 45 minutes, the coach wondered how many years you'd been playing. So did it feel natural to you when you were out there hitting for the first time, or were you just shocked that someone should think that you were good?
Yeah, it was completely just natural. It was as if I was just going out to play a game with friends, and didn't really think about it. I just put the racket in my hand and the ball came to me and I hit it. It just went over the court and into the over the net and into the court.
But were you aware that that's actually not a very easy thing to do?
No, I was not aware of that at all. I thought it was normal.
So when the coach said to you, how long have you been playing? And you said 45 minutes. He said, yeah. I don't know how many years.
Exactly.
What was your reaction?
Well, I just thought, well, why is he asking me that? I didn't know what I did was that great or anything special. And I just remember just saying, no, it's my first day. And he told me to come back the next day with my parents.
But had you done anything before that involved hand-eye? Had you played baseball and you were good at batting? No?
I was actually not into sports before tennis at all. I wanted to be a pediatrician.
Right. Okay, so it was actually a revelation to you.
Yeah, I mean, I was just another girl at school who would, you know, run around at recess on the playground. And, you know, at home, my mom, she always had us outside. You know, after school, we were always outside playing with friends, running around, hide and seek, you know, hopscotch, jump rope, just always outdoors and playing games and running around. But, yeah, no sport per se in particular until then.
And yet you were the second best in your state at under 12 level within 2 years.
Yeah, 2 years later, I was ranked number one in Florida, 12 and unders. I was ranked number one in America. I won the national championships for the 12 and unders. And I lost in the finals of the Orange Bowl. So that would be probably equivalent back then in the day. They would consider you about number two in the world in under 12s.
Number two in the world.
Yeah.
Does it make you wonder about the concept of nature versus nurture? Because you were clearly naturally very good at it.
Right.
And yet you had the mentality to work hard.
That is also interesting observation. I think that from a young age, you know, there was also my dad that became very involved in my tennis from literally day one, from my first lesson, who was always there watching everything. And he worked me very hard. But I think, you know, thinking back, you're probably right when having that mentality of hardworking, you know, I think. And my mom instilled that in me as well. You know, just it was just part of, I guess, the mentality at home is just when you do something, just try to do it your best.
When you came onto the tour, you won a tour level event at 16. You were very impressive because you took power hitting to a new level. Everyone used to rave about Steffi Graf's forehand, but you hit the forehand as powerfully and you hit the backhand as powerfully as your forehand, her forehand. Were you conscious of doing something bigger and more powerfully than was custom practice on the WTA tour at the time?
Definitely. From the beginning of my tennis, my dad always told me to hit the ball as hard as I can. And, you know, he would tell me, don't worry if it doesn't go in. It's going to eventually come in. Just keep hitting the ball. Be aggressive. So it was always everything we did in practice and how he spoke to me and trained me. It was all to be the best, to win, to be aggressive, to hit the ball hard. You know, it's kind of like you got to go out there and take it. No one's going to give it to you. And playing my junior matches, a lot of my junior matches, 1200s, I won a lot of matches 6-0, 6-0, or 6-0, 6-1, or 6-1, 6-0, or it was, yeah, I won a lot of matches because I was very aggressive and I would hit the ball very hard. And then I just brought that into my professional career, my professional tennis. And yeah, at 14 years old, playing professional, so I was able to hit the ball as hard or harder than women that were playing on the tour. And that was, you know, that was my game, that was my strength, was my power, was my hard hitting. And I was trained that way from the beginning in practice. And physically, also, you know, people always thought that I was older when I was a kid, like 2 years older than my age, because I was taller than most of the girls and I was strong physically. My dad also had me doing, you know, fitness training from an early age as well, running the mile every day, timing me. Had to be in under a certain time. He had me doing like sit-ups and push-ups and light weights and jump rope and sprints and running up hills. And so from a young age, I was, you know, trained pretty hard.
Did you do that with your brother as well? Or was the focus on you because he could see that you could be a very good tennis player?
My brother was, he was interesting because my brother had the choice. And my father would ask my brother if he would want to practice after school that day. And most of the time, my brother would say, no, I'm going to go home. I'm going to watch cartoons. And I'm like, well, he's not asking me. Why don't I have the choice? Like, I don't have a choice. I'm like, here's your tennis racket and we're going to the court, you know? And so my brother, yeah, he didn't... He very rarely wanted to come out and practice, actually. I think he regrets it today, actually.
Much as you could be grateful for that now, were you resentful of it at the time?
Yes. I, because you're 10, 11, 12 years old, you want to go home and play with your friends, and you want to go out and ride your bike in the neighborhood, and, yeah, you might want to go home and watch cartoons or, you know, sometimes. And so it was... It was actually hard, you know, because I didn't have what people would call what is normal. What is normal? But that was not a normal, you know, childhood, as I was playing tennis a lot and training, having tournaments on the weekend, getting more and more serious with the competition. Then, you know, I wasn't allowed to go out and do certain things because I had to rest. I wasn't allowed to eat certain things because, you know, you can't have cake and candy and ice cream and, you know, all these kind of things.
Did you ever rebel against that?
Well, no. not for the first 18 years of my life. No, I mean, I respected my parents. I pretty much, you know, did what they told me. That's pretty much, yeah, like how I saw it.
Now, anyone listening to this without knowing your backstory will say, well, that's perfectly reasonable parenting. But, of course, your father was erratic, to say the least. Mm-hmm. And there came a point when you were about 18 when he was banned mm-hmm. from being at tournaments because his behavior was just unacceptable and inappropriate. Mm-hmm. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, it was really, really hard. It was very difficult. You know, I don't know, honestly. You know, my mom was a great support. You know, she was like my pillar, my rock, my best friend. She was always there for me whenever I needed it to talk to or to cry with. Or, you know, my dad was, you know, he was very, very hard in training. It was military boot camp style, to say the least, how you would train 18-year-old and older men, basically, and not a young girl, basically. He was verbally and physically abusive, and I thought that as I got better and better as a tennis player that it would get less and less, but actually it was the opposite. And the better that I got, it was like the more pressure and the more stress and the more expectation and demands, you know, came from my father. So obviously he wanted me to be a champion. He wanted me to be the best. He wanted to be number one. He believed in me. He trained me hard in the ways that, you know, I think that he thought was the best. Because obviously I'm his daughter and he loves me. He wants the best for me. But obviously it wasn't, you know, it wasn't in the most healthiest of ways. So I grew up in fear, I guess you could say, you know, and fearing my dad, that I had to have a good practice, or else he was going to get mad. I had to win, and I had to win playing good, because even winning and not playing good wasn't good enough. So it was a lot to deal with. It was a lot of stress. It was a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. And then, unfortunately, you know, my heart grew. You know, you start to have hatred in your heart. You start to, you know, your heart starts to become hard and you don't really realize it. And then there's anger and unforgiveness and all kinds of things that I think as a child you kind of don't really understand or aren't aware of very much. But all you know is that you're angry and you're scared. I think those were like the main emotions, I think, that I grew up with until I was 18, basically. So, like, as you said, I couldn't wait to be 18 because then I was like, well, when I'm 18, I'm an adult. That's the legal age. We think we're adults, but we're not fully developed yet. Until a brain, usually, I think they say until you're 25, but that's the legal age. I said, okay, when I'm 18, I'm out of here. No one can tell me what to do, and I'm gone. So that's pretty much what happened at Roland Garros.
Did you ever confront him? Did you ever say, Daddy, don't talk to me like this? Or was he just too damaged and therefore fearful?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know if I actually ever did, because I think you were just too afraid of his reaction or how he might react, you know, towards you. My brother did one time. That didn't go so well.
What happened?
Well, you know, I think my brother, as he was getting a little bit older and he thought, he's becoming a young man, he thinks he's strong, that he can kind of stand up to him a little bit, you know, and try to maybe protect me or to protect my mom. But yeah, no, my dad hit him and that didn't go very well. So basically, my dad was very, very strong, you know, physically. So yeah, that you just kind of, yeah, you didn't say anything, basically.
And so at Roland Garros, you sought advice from one of the senior tour supervisors.
Well, it was really amazing. You know, late Georgina Clark from the WTA, an amazing, exceptional woman, like a mother figure on the tour. And, you know, I would often have bruises on my body or, you know, especially on my arms where often my dad would grab me. And I remember at the Roland Garros, there I'm 18 years old, and I would stay in the locker room quite a while after my matches because that was a safe place for me because I knew my father couldn't come in there. It was only for women. And so I would sit in there for a little while after my matches. And I remember Georgina came up to me, and she saw, you know, the bruises on my arm, and I was just sitting there. And she looked at me and she said, are you okay? And I basically just shook my head. I didn't say anything. I just shook my head no. And she said, would you like some help? And I nodded my head yes. And she said, okay. And so we spoke, you know, about ways that the WTA could basically help me. And there are rules in tennis, and if there is someone in the crowd that's being disruptive to play or to the, you know, the players, etc., that they can be removed by security. And so, you know, she said, well, I'll be at your next match and we'll see how things go. And if at any moment, if your dad is being disruptive, which he has in the past been disruptive, then she said, you know, we can remove him from the stands with security. Are you okay with that? I said, yes. So next day, my next match, playing against Kimberly Poe from America, and I lose the first set. And my dad was very unhappy, to say the least. And he stood up in the crowd, and he screamed at me, and he screamed some obscenities and inappropriate language. And, you know, it's quite embarrassing. It was quite embarrassing for me as a player. And that at that moment, you know, Georgina was there in the stand and looked at me and nodded my head. And so that's when the security proceeded to come to my father and just, you know, asked him to please, you know, keep quiet and et cetera. And then he got mad at them and yelled. And so then they asked for him to leave, and he said no, and created a scene, and then they actually had to remove him. So removed him. And yeah, it was quite a scene. He was literally dragged and kicking and screaming. And that was then the moment when he was removed from Roland Garros, and they put him outside of the gates, and he couldn't come back in. And you know, I proceeded with my match, and I won the second set.
Were you aware of the commotion going on?
100%. It was all happening right in front of me. I could see and hear everything. And then basically I won the match. And that was from that moment on, you know, my life completely changed in a way where I was provided security. I had bodyguards because, you know, we feared for our lives, my mother, myself, and my brother, because, you know, you didn't know what my dad could do or was going to do, you know, at any moment. So it was quite an experience that I'll share more into detail when I write my book.
But we know that to be a successful tennis player, you need ambitious people backing you. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there is always the risk that a parent will overstep the mark. In most cases, it doesn't happen. What would you say to any young woman who feels that one of her support team, whether it's a parent, whether it's someone else, is overstepping the mark? Is there anything you feel, on the basis of your experience, you would say?
Definitely get help. And there is help out there, and to not be afraid. There are things that can be put in place to help you and to protect you and to keep you safe, and that you definitely do not need to stay in any type of abusive situation or abusive relationship, no matter what type that is, if it's verbal, emotional, mental, physical, sexual. Any kind of abuse is unacceptable, and no one deserves any type of abuse. You know, we all deserve to be treated with love and with respect and with truth, and to reach out to, you know, like for me, I was on the tour, so there was the WTA. You know, they were there and they're available. So definitely to not remain silent and to not be afraid, and that there is a way out, and that they don't have to live with that every day.
Tennis Worthy is not just a podcast. It's also a video series dedicated to the triumphs and challenges Hall of Famers and legends have overcome. From Arthur Ashe to Billie Jean King's resiliency, and Martina Navratilova's sacrifice of defecting from her homeland for a better future. Tennis Worthy tells the best stories of the game from the best players in the game through the defining values of tennis. To watch, visit tennisfame.com/tennisworthy. Each year, the International Tennis Hall of Fame bestows the ultimate honor in tennis to those who have set themselves apart, both on and off the court. The 260 individuals in the Hall of Fame hail from 27 countries and are enshrined in the museum at the Hall of Fame in Newport, Rhode Island. In addition to the legacies of the Hall of Famers on display, from Dick Sears to Andre Agassi to Chrissy Evert and more, the museum boasts a stunning collection of tennis history that is open daily. Plan your trip to the International Tennis Hall of Fame at tennisfame.com/visit. Let's send it back now to Chris Bowers for more of his conversation with Hall of Famer Mary Pierce.
Roland Garros 94, your first Grand Slam final. Yeah. You were superb against Graf in the semis, who she was the top seed. Were you out-psyched in the final by Arantxa Sánchez Vicario or by the Rainbreaks?
By the fact that it was my first Grand Slam final and that it was Roland Garros. And playing, you know, for France at your home Grand Slam with the French crowd and just feeling, you know, all the excitement of the whole country and all the expectation of the whole country, you know, wanting you to win and to play well. I was just really, really nervous, and especially nervous about doing a speech in French because English is my first language, and I didn't feel 100% completely confident in, you know, my speech and what I wanted to say in French, and I was very nervous about that, so I lost a lot of sleep, actually, thinking about my speech more than my tennis match.
Because French was, yes, it was your second language, even though you spoke it with your mother at home. Did you feel that there was extra pressure on you to prove that you were legitimately French? Was that part of it?
You know, I lived in America until I was 13 years old, and my dad didn't want us to speak French at home because he didn't speak French, so he didn't want us to be able to speak and him not understand what we were saying. So I learned French when I came to France when I was 13 years old, and I learned basically through my cousins who could speak English and also my mom who helped to teach me. But I think that you want to do well because you're in France and, you know, you're playing for your country and for your people and for your fans and for your family. So it was a lot of extra pressure.
You did something remarkable in that final. During one of the rain breaks, you came out into the what's now the Philippe Chatrier Arena, was then just the center court, and a TV interviewer saw you, and you gave a short interview during one of the rain breaks. Now, that's very, very unusual. Was that calculated? Was that, are you comfortable with that, or do you look back and say that was inexperience on your part, or what?
It was not calculated, first of all. And, you know, there was, I think, a couple of rain breaks that day, which made it very difficult being on and off and waiting, and kind of the fans were sitting in the stands under their umbrellas. And so I just kind of would pop my head out every once in a while just to see what the weather was looking like and the court and if there were any fans still there. And, I don't know, there just happened, I guess, to be a journalist there, and he wanted to ask me a few questions, and I said, sure, okay, why not? I'm here, it's okay, I'm not going to play immediately, so sure, I'll do it.
And then within a year, you were on the Grand Slam Roll of Honour. You won the Australian Open in 95, beating Arantxa in the final. Did that feel like redemption or just a natural progression? Or what was the main feeling that you had in finally winning one of the four majors?
Well, it was amazing. I remember that year, 95, starting the year and setting my goals. And my goals was to win a Grand Slam tournament and finish the year top five. And within the first month of the year, I achieved my goals, winning a Grand Slam and finishing number three in the world. So, and with my team, we sat down, I was like, oh, wait, we got to set some new goals for the year.
Monthly goals.
But no, it was absolutely amazing. It was absolutely incredible. I mean, it's what you train so hard for, you know, as a professional tennis player. It's what you live for. It's to win Grand Slam titles. And those moments, you know, when it happens, I mean, there's just so much that goes into it. You know, all of the hard work and all the years of sacrifice and discipline and hard work. it's all for that moment that you win. And it's just so satisfying and so rewarding. And it's also at the same time, you have feelings of like, oh, I can't believe I actually did this. This is like, it's just amazing. And you're just obviously also very proud of yourself and grateful and thankful to also your, you know, your team that is there with you to help you achieve that.
Does winning a Grand Slam make you go back through all the stages, to go back to the day you, as a 10-year-old, you hit your first tennis ball, various milestones in your teens? Did you find yourself doing that?
Definitely. It's kind of like, you know, they say your life flashes before your eyes. So you have like your tennis life kind of that kind of flashes before you, and you can in 1 second kind of just, well, maybe not one, maybe 3 seconds, but you see all your tennis life flash before your eyes, and just really everything that you've been through. And it's hard, you know, and how much you've suffered, and you think, yeah, okay, this is what it's for, and it's all worth it.
It's 5 years before you win your next Grand Slam title and your first doubles title. When one looks back on your Roland Garros title in 2000, it came not out of the blue, but you started 2000 at a pretty low ebb.
Yeah, trying to remember. I think the week before Roland Garros, I think I actually, you know, didn't have great results, and I had a shoulder injury, and you know, wasn't too sure if I was going to be able to play Roland Garros or not. So, you know, kind of going into it at not what you're thinking, like your best of forms in kind of every way, you know, mentally and physically. And it was just amazing. I kind of remember my brother was my coach at the time, and just we were really talking with the medical team and also with my fitness coach, and just, you know, what should I do? And I thought, you know, I'll just give it a try. I'll just give it a try and see how it goes. And, you know, I had to do a lot of treatment on my shoulder every day, like 2 hours in the morning before I could even hit a ball or warm up, and then 2 hours in the evening after I finished all my matches and everything. So I was very often the first person to arrive and the last person to leave every day.
And were the lower expectations that you had instrumental in you winning the title?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think, you know, part of that you can think, maybe less expectations, less pressure. I didn't think I was, you know, in that situation ideally to win the tournament that year. But, you know, actually the thing, if I want to call it that, that really helped me at Roland Garros to be able to play my best tennis, you know, because it was always so hard as a French player to play Roland Garros because you have all this extra pressure and stress playing your home Grand Slam. It was actually my faith. It was in March of 2000 that I became a born-again Christian. And when that happened in my life, it literally changed me. It changed me as a person from inside out. It changed my heart. It changed my mind. It just, you know, all my past hurts and wounds that I had been carrying with me from my childhood and everything that I had been through with my dad, you know, the Lord came and healed my heart and took away all of that pain, the suffering that I was carrying with me all of those years. You know, everyone could look at Mary Pierce from the outside and think, oh, wow, Mary looks great. Mary's got a great life. Everything's perfect. But they couldn't see my heart. They couldn't know what I was feeling and the suffering that I was carrying around and the pain that I was carrying, the unforgiveness, the hatred, the fear, and the state of my heart, basically. And when I gave my life to the Lord, well, then he showed me how I needed to forgive my dad. And I was like, oh, no. My dad did too many bad things for too long. And no, I can't forgive him. I won't forgive him. He doesn't deserve it. And the Lord said to me, well, who are you to not forgive? You know, I forgive everyone, you know, for all of their sins. And I was like, okay, yes, Lord, you're right. Forgive me. And I said, but help me. I need a miracle to be able to forgive my dad. And Lord is amazing. You know, he did that miracle in my heart. I was able to forgive my dad And it was like it never happened. And it happened to someone else in another lifetime. And then the next step was, okay, but I don't love my dad. And I said, Lord, I know that you love my dad. You love everyone. And I know that I'm called, you know, as a Christian to love. And I said, well, you know, Lord, help me. I need another miracle to have your heart and your love for my father. And the Lord did that miracle as well in my heart. And I was able to forgive my dad and to love my dad. And our relationship was, it started to be reestablished and restored. And we started to, you know, see each other and to spend time together. And that totally changed me. And it brought peace into my heart and into my life. It brought the healing that I needed in my heart. And at that moment, also, I knew and I realized that, well, God has given me this gift and this ability to play tennis, because I could play tennis from the first day, like, because I'd been playing for years. So this was God's plan for me to do this. And so I wanted to do my best for the Lord to glorify him in everything that I did. And when I got to Roland Garros, well, it was like, you know, there's no stress. There's no pressure.
So how did you feel going into the final against Conchita Martinez in 2000, mm-hmm. compared with how you'd gone into the final against Arantxa in 1994? What was the difference?
It was a huge difference. I slept very well the night before, first of all, which makes a big difference to be able to perform on court. But, you know, I went into that whole tournament from the beginning just at peace and relaxed and knowing that, you know what, I'm not in control. God is in control. He has this all in his hands, that all I have to do is to go out there and give 100% of myself and just have fun and enjoy the moment and enjoy being out there on the court. So it was like all the pressure and all the stress, all the patience, it just disappeared. And you could even tell on my face that there was, I was just much more relaxed and much more at peace. And the journalists in France, they would all interview me from the beginning of the tournament even. They said, oh, wow, Mary, you know, you look so different. You know, you look like so much more at peace and relaxed, even like you're not getting as mad as you used to on the court and important points. You seem very serene. And what kind of mental training have you done? And I said, well, I haven't done any mental training, you know. And I said, the only difference in my life is that now I'm a Christian and everything's in God's hands.
But the dialogue you were talking about when you tried to come to terms with your father, was that just through prayer and your own personal meditations, or was that with the help of a cleric, a pastor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a good question. So I obviously had, you know, someone on the tour who had shared the gospel with me and who was a Christian. And so when I became a Christian, this other player was there to, you know, first of all, of course, be my friend and to help me. But, you know, a lot of it was in the beginning was me and the Lord and the Bible. And also I started to be a part of a church, attend a church and, you know, meet the pastor. And then they have also counselors and care pastors and people that you can talk to and seek biblical counsel and wise advice that you can talk to as well to help you.
See, there are some coaches who would say, yeah, it's wonderful that you're at peace and that, you know, you've found what's right for you, but actually you need a certain edginess to win top level tennis matches. But you obviously didn't feel that took anything away from you on a court.
On the contrary. No, you have to have that killer instinct when you get out on the court. I understand what that means. You know, you go out on the court and you play, you're competitive, you want to win, but it's not in a hatred kind of way. It's not in a mean kind of way. It's not in a, I wish bad to my opponent and I hope that they miss the shot and lose. No, that's very negative way of thinking and acting.
And was that how you saw it before?
No, but I think that a lot of people can think that that's what that means. And it's not. Like, I think, look at all of the greatest champions. They're so humble and they're so respectful, you know. And I think the main thing is, you know, once again, looking at yourself and being the best that you can be. And when you go out and compete on the court, of course you want to win. No one, nobody wants to lose. You're competing. But for me, it was going out there and it's fighting. It's like, it's never giving up. It's trying hard. It's always giving your best, for running for every ball until the last point, you know, and it's more focused on yourself and what you can do on your side of the net and playing the ball, and not so worried about the person or who you're playing or who your opponent is. Yes, you need to know their strength and their weaknesses and have your strategies in place and plan A and plan B and all those kind of things. But being, you can be a Christian and have a pure heart and have nothing against anyone and also compete and want to do your best.
At that Roland Garros in 2000, you also won your first women's doubles title, your only Grand Slam women's doubles title, with Martina Hingis, who'd beaten you in a singles final a couple of years earlier. What was that like?
Gosh, that was amazing. I mean, to play doubles with Martina Hingis was a lot of fun. She's funny, and her mom was her coach, so we had a lot of great times on the court. And she's just an amazing player, obviously. You know, I always loved playing the singles, the doubles, the mixed doubles at the Grand Slams. It was a lot of fun. Doubles, I loved playing doubles all the time. It was fun being on the court with your partner, and you can work on your shots in tennis. It's great to work on things that you want to work on in doubles to implement in your singles, serves, returns, and your volleys. And, you know, it was, that year was extra challenging playing the doubles because of my shoulder injury. And I remember one day going, I was in the car with my brother and we're riding over to Roland Garros from the hotel, and I could barely lift my arm. And I said, gosh, I don't know how I'm going to play doubles today. So I get there, I do my treatment, it's feeling a little bit better. And I see Martina, and I said, Martina, you know, my shoulder's really hurting today, so I think you're going to serve first. And when I serve, I'm just going to do my best to get it in the box, and we're just going to see what happens. She's like, yeah, okay, no problem, don't worry. So there was, you know, all I could do was just get the serve in the box basically that day, and we won the match. So it was a little bit more challenging just because of my shoulder injury, but to be able to play both and to win both is just absolutely incredible mentally, emotionally, and physically. It's something that, yeah, I'm very proud of that.
So you go into Roland Garros with a shoulder injury, you end up being the singles and doubles champion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's why you just never know. Just always have to try.
You had one more Grand Slam title, which was mixed doubles in 2005, which you won with Mahesh Bhupathi.
Yes, yeah, that was a lot of fun. I had been wanting to play with Mahesh for a few years, but, you know, he was already taken, already booked as one of the greatest doubles and mixed doubles players with so many Grand Slam titles. And then, yeah, finally we got to play together. I loved it. And when we won that Wimbledon mixed doubles title, I remember that trophy was like, I was almost as proud of, like, the most proud of that one. And of course, my Roland Garros trophy is my dream come true in tennis. But that one was very special, my Wimbledon trophy. And I had it on my nightstand. I put it on my nightstand that night right next to me when I went to sleep.
Because grass wasn't your best surface, but you're a Wimbledon champion and you were a quarterfinalist in singles.
Yes, exactly. I did not like the idea of playing on grass in the beginning of my career. I did not feel comfortable on grass in the beginning of my career either. I didn't like it at all. Moving around it was very uncomfortable for me. And it took me a few years to finally understand how to play on grass. And when I understood, then I enjoyed it a lot. And then I had a lot more fun on it.
We haven't mentioned Fed Cup. That was obviously very important for you as somebody who was, and you had French nationality from birth, but you chose to play for France, but you didn't speak the language till you were 13. Mm-hmm. How important was it to win those titles in 97 and 2003?
Yeah, it was very special. It was when I was 13 years old and we moved to France that my dad decided and chose, and he said, you know what, when we needed help, the French Tennis Federation responded positively, and so you're going to play for France and be loyal to that country. And
that was interesting, given that he didn't speak French and didn't want you to speak French.
Yes, well, the USTA did offer to help, but my father said that he was the coach, and they said, well, Mary has to work with one of our national coaches. And my father said, no, I'm the coach. And they said, well, sorry, we can't help you. And that's when my father asked my mother to contact the French Tennis Federation and ask if they would help. And they said yes, and that's why we moved to France. And then I started to learn to speak French. And 2 years later, I was selected for Fed Cup, which was a huge honor for me. And I just felt so young that they would, you know, select me already at such a young age. It was a huge honor for me.
But when you won it in 2003, that was you and Amélie Mauresmo playing singles, which is one of the strongest teams France has ever had.
Yes. You know, I'm the only player that's on both of the French Fed Cup winning teams in 97 and 2003. And it was just, it was a very special experience, you know, because tennis is such an individual sport. And this is the time where you actually get to come together as a team and help each other and play for your country. And we had, we had very strong team, obviously, in 97. And then we had an amazingly strong team as well in 2003. You know, we made another Fed Cup final, France, in 2005. But, you know, winning that year, I mean, obviously with Amélie Mauresmo and I, we were both two players in the top five, basically. We had a very strong team.
And then after your playing career, which ended with a horrific knee injury, you put something back by contributing to the ITF. Tell us about what it was that motivated you to want to give something back through that route.
Yeah, you know, I think that tennis has given me so much, and I've learned so much through it. And I also see that, you know, from my life and from my travels around the world and different continents and different countries, I just see how privileged I am and how much I do have, and that I want to really help and make a difference. You know, I'm very passionate about development, you know, grassroots, spreading tennis through schools and giving young girls and boys the opportunity and exposing them to tennis. Because if I wasn't exposed to it, I would have never played it, you know, and giving them that opportunity to play tennis. So I was asked by, you know, David Haggerty, the new president of the ITF, almost 8 years ago when he was elected. He created a new position on the board of the ITF for a female player representative and a male player representative, and I was asked to be a part of the board. And, you know, I spoke to David about what are their goals and how I could help. And I thought it would be very interesting for me to be a part of the board and, you know, to be on the other side of tennis now and to learn the other side as well. And to be able to help and to contribute and to give my insight and feedback from a player perspective. And also for the female players as well in tennis and on the board. So, yeah, it's been really interesting. I've learned a lot, and this is my second term. I'm in my second term right now. And they're each 4 years. Each term is 4 years. So coming to the end of my second term. And, it's been really, really fun. It's been really exciting, and I've been learning a lot.
In 2019, you were inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. What did that mean to you, and what was the induction like as an experience for you?
Yes, that's a great question. I've been nominated, I think, once or twice before. And I saw I was nominated again, and I was like, oh boy, this is my year. And I remember Stan Smith calling me and telling me that I would be inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame in 2019. And I was just so, I mean, you can't even put it into words. I was just so excited, and I was just so happy. And it's such a proud moment in your life for all of your tennis achievements to be recognized as one of the best in the history of tennis. I mean, for me, that's mind-blowing. It's humbling. You know, I look at Chris Evert and John McEnroe and, I mean, all these players that I watched and admired, and know that they're in the International Tennis Hall of Fame, and to think that I'm also going to be in the International Tennis Hall of Fame with them, I'm just like, wow. it's just amazing. I was very nervous. I remember that. Nervous for my speech as well. but just felt extremely humbled, just extremely, extremely humbled and very proud that everything that I achieved in my career is being recognized as one of the best and the history of the game, and I think back to my life and to all of everything that I've been through and all the difficulties and the suffering, and just see how much it was worth it.
It also allowed you to acknowledge the role of Nick Bollettieri, who sort of stepped in when you had all the difficulties with your dad as your coach, and he introduced you.
Yes, he came into my life at a time where I separated from my family, and Nick became, in a way, like a second dad to me. And for pretty much the rest of my career, Nick was like my coach, my head coach. I would go and train there at his academy, and he always had a part in my tennis career and in my life. And he would talk to you because he cared, and he'd give you advice. And I was very grateful for the place that Nick also had in my tennis career and in my life. So yeah, he has a very, very special place in my heart and in my life.
And finally, if there's anybody in the tennis world or a group of people you'd give advice to, maybe youngsters, maybe parents, what would it be?
Well, giving advice to the youngsters, I think it's important first to know, like, you know, why are you playing tennis? What do you want? What are your goals? What are your dreams? And very important to have a dream. My dream was to win Roland Garros one day. And I'm grateful, amazingly grateful, that my dream came true in tennis. So the dreams are the fuel that fire you up those days when you're tired, when you don't want to do it, and you're wondering, why am I doing this? And then you think about, oh, my dream. That's why I'm doing this. To dream, to work hard, because, you know, everyone's like, what's the secret? What's the secret? That's the secret. Work hard. Always give 100%. So that you don't ever, ever have any regrets. Always play honest, always play fair, and always give your best. As far as to the parents, you know, if the parent is in whatever level that they are involved, because I do believe that parents need to be involved in their child lives, if it's their school, if it's their sport, relationships, whatever it is, children need their parents. They need their love. And they need their support. They need to feel like their parent is present and cares. So if they're a coach or if they're not a coach, either way, what's so important is unconditional love, so that however they perform on the court, if they play well or bad, if they win or if they lose, that they know that when they come off the court, that they don't have to fear you, that they can come to you, they can talk to you, they can seek wise counsel from you, they can seek comfort from you and guidance for their lives, so that there's that relationship of trust, of love. And I always say, you know, treat your child the same. You know, if they win or if they lose, treat them the same. Don't treat them any different, because you're teaching them then that their value is not in their performance or what they can achieve, but it's in who they are as a person. And they deserve that love and respect no matter how they perform on a tennis court or not.
Mary Pierce, thank you very much for sharing your insights into your experiences in life and tennis.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
What a great quote to remember. The dreams are what fuel you on the days when you're tired and just don't want to do it. Well said, Mary. We couldn't agree more. And a huge thank you for being so open and honest with us in your conversation here on Tennis Worthy. If you like what you heard from Mary and in the other episodes of Tennis Worthy, please share the show. The greatest compliment you can give us is to share it with people you care about. The Tennis Worthy podcast was created by the International Tennis Hall of Fame in association with the Tennis Radio Network. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.